Speakers in this session are both PCA affiliated, so obviously you're all predestined to be here. And let's see, here we go on the start. Finishing up postdoc, if you happen to know anybody that will pay somebody to identify mollusks, I'd be interested to hear about it. There are a couple of questions that see ask often relating to evolution. Probably a more popular level question is, why don't we see, say, new phyla or something like that evolving today if evolution is true? A more sophisticated question is relating to the overall pattern of origination. We generally see the higher categories appearing earlier in the fossil record and lower ones a bit later. For example, most of the phyla, at least the ones that have nice hard parts, are present by the end of the Cambrian. And so I'm wanting to look at, does this pattern that we see pose a significant problem for conventional evolutionary models or not? Now, there are a number of related questions. For example, why do you have apparently relatively rapid radiation in the Cambrian that I'm not dealing with? There's papers out there that kind of address those types of things. And since I'm talking about them a lot, just a quick review, if you don't remember from general biology, kingdoms include phyla, or divisions if you're talking about plants. Those include classes, then orders, families, genera, species. And yes, extra, and aggravation are genuine scientific names of things. And you can add other classes as well. And typically, any one of these higher categories will include a few to a whole lot of lower categories. What's the pattern that we see? There is some tendency to kind of exaggerate a bit the amount of stuff coming in the Cambrian. This isn't just some wacko anti-evolution person making stuff up. You do see standard biology textbooks saying all the phyla appear right there in the Cambrian, and that's not really the case, but they are concentrated around that time. We do see a number of things in the pre-Cambrian. Then usually there's only one thing that's got a decent skeleton to it that we don't see before the end of the Cambrian. And then if you look at, instead of phyla, classes, they tend to come in, a number of them are in the Cambrian, a few more a little later on, and so on down at different levels. You do, however, have some peaks in numbers of new things at various times later on in the fossil record. Pattern is similar, but a little more spread out generally if you look at other groups besides animals. Animals really have the biggest peak right at the Cambrian. It's probably, of course, you don't have a great fossil record on the fungi, but it tends to be a little more spread out than the others. And then we have a number of things that we only know is recent, usually stuff that's all soft, gooey, and doesn't fossilize well. Here's just a couple of examples, and particularly for the early part here in the Paleozoic, there's some debate as to what really qualifies as a distinct class. This one on the left is just kind of what I came up with off the top of my head for recognizing different classes. And then this is a published diagram, and from 1968, it's a little dated. I went ahead and showed there was stuff in the Cambrian, but other than that, I haven't adjusted it. And we see that at the superfamily level, it's relatively low in the broad scheme of biological categories. We don't reach the peak until relatively late up in the Cretaceous, and we've got dinosaurs running around and whatnot for bivalve superfamilies. But the class level, much more inclusive category, like snails are one class of mollusks, we see there's at least one mollusk-looking thing we've got good evidence for back in the pre-Cambrian. And then phyla diversity that appear before the end of the Cambrian. There's some turnover here. These aren't exactly the same groups, but about the same number. A few more things we're starting to see, but then these squares that aren't as shaded in are groups that disappear from the fossil record. One of them soft-bodied, the other in the modern ones are entirely deep sea. And then that white square at the top is a soft-bodied form that we don't know from the fossil record. So overall, the classes seem to be reaching their peak a lot earlier than the superfamilies in this example. Now, part of this pattern is what we expect just on how we give names to things. This is a hierarchical system, and so, for example, if you found a mammal or a bird or a fish or a reptile, amphibian, any of those means you've got vertebrates. And so any higher category, its first appearance will be the oldest time for any of the included categories. As a perhaps more familiar example, on last names, those are inherited in family, and so last name of Campbell has been around since mid-medieval is kind of the earliest documentation of them, much to the regret of a number of neighboring families in Scotland. And then, in turn, other Scots have been around. They were causing trouble for the Romans long before we heard of Campbells. There is one particular exception, things that are classified incertae sedis, uncertain category. Sometimes you've got a nice distinctive fossil, you'd like to talk about the thing, but you don't really know what it is. Particularly the case with some early fossils, not sure, is this the whole thing? Is this just a little piece of it or what? And this is just one example, kind of memorable on the name. They did think of something that they thought it looked like and called it gluteus minimus. But just what sort of animal, or even if it was an animal as opposed to protist or something else, these came from, they couldn't figure out. Also, when you're naming a higher category, you generally pick features that you think apply at a broad level, so tend to have relatively generic characteristics labeling it. And we may be able to recognize a higher category even if we're not too sure about the lower one. So this is a bunch of snails I've been working on lately. I've got a bunch of DNA data on them, but I still don't know just what species these two are. We've got a couple of different complications involved. This one, given that's from the right area and the right shape, I'm pretty sure is an endangered one, but what to make of the other two still up in the air. Also, typically, there's a good deal of nomenclatural conservatism. If you have something that looks really weird, but it turns out that you can connect it to an existing category, usually folks just say, okay, it's a really weird one of those, rather than making up a totally new category. So anybody know, of course this is partly my drawing abilities, but any guess as to what this parasite here might be? Got our kind of root-like part that sticks into the host and then external bit as well up there. It turns out that this thing is a barnacle. Fellow over there worked a lot on barnacles, kind of got distracted on other things as well, but did deal with those. And it turns out a perfectly good, ordinary baby barnacle grows up into this strange-looking thing when it attaches onto a crab, hermit crab in this particular case. And so rather than saying this thing doesn't have any standard characteristic of an arthropod, much less a crustacean or barnacle, so we'll make a new phylum, you say, well, we'll just call it a really weird barnacle. Another example, deep-sea sponge here, and it's got little spicules and things like that. Most features, it looks like a standard, ordinary deep-sea sponge, but the things feed by trapping small animals that stick on the surface, and they've entirely lost the system of pores that is characteristic for sponges as a whole, since the phylum Porifera. Another factor that goes into this is fossilization patterns. Fossil record is pretty patchy, so once again, a more inclusive category, better chance you have of finding something that fits into it. General study of this known as taphonomy. There are many factors that affect preservation, what we can tell. But even if you have a poor fossil, you may be able to tell something about, or good, but not quite what you want. So if you just find some sort of jointed leg like this, you know there were arthropods around. What kind? That much you probably couldn't say what kind, but at least it was an arthropod. Or again, an example, there's a spot in Alabama with lots of footprints from coal age deposits. In fact, it's a coal mine for the site. And you've got these big footprints conspicuously match a plecosaur. We don't have any bones for anything there. We don't know anything about anything but their feet, but they were plecosaurs. Another factor on fossil record relates to where we find exceptional preservation. These are commonly referred to as Lagerstätten. And those later peaks and appearance of new taxa tend to be associated with them, or for that matter, even the Cambrian, we have exceptional preservation. So, for example, there are a couple of examples where we have an insect in amber, and here's this little parasitic worm emerging from it, stuck in there. And that's about the only way you can get a decent fossil of something like that. So until you have amber deposits, you have very poor chance of getting anything like that. And for various reasons in geologic time, at certain points, there are deposits that nicely preserve particular types of things, and we generally see, hey, that's the first known example of this group or another group. Again, fossilization, older you get, the more chance for things to be lost. And so this, again, a bigger category, better chances. Also, ecologically, different environments. A larger category tends to include more things. Oh, if you get a bird guide for Australia and one for North America, there are about a dozen species in common if you count pigeons and things like that. But at the order level, almost all of them are both places. We don't have cassowaries here, but most of the orders are in both places. Similarly, snails, usually a family to superfamily, is either freshwater or land or marine. But at higher categories, you can get more. Another problem with fossilization is sometimes the key feature to recognize something is lousy for fossilization. The key feature to tell a snail from something that's not exactly a snail is whether the body is twisted relative to the head and foot region. And, of course, Ellis was kind of tongue-in-cheek saying this. We can have a pretty confident idea that if we see something very much like a modern snail, that it had similar anatomy. But when you get back, particularly very early in the fossil record, there are these kind of coiled, cap-shaped things. And being certain whether they were twisted around or not is quite difficult. However, pretty sure that they were mollusks. Now, of course, any of these apply to any origin scenario. But there are some evolutionary considerations as well. From an evolutionary perspective, we expect a higher category to be something that evolved earlier. And so the oldest fossils may have gotten the key feature for, say, phylum or class, but not at a lower level. Or they could kind of have a combination of their transitions. So this is, can't say I'm all that artistically skilled, but the basic idea is that this tall cap-shaped shell that's got chambers partitioning off the back end. And this is almost, but not quite, what you need to have a good cephalopod, like a nautilus, squid, octopus type of thing. The one thing that's needed beyond this is to have connections going back in there so the animal can control what's going on back in those chambers. And so we've got a transitional, but it's not quite a cephalopod, but we're sure it's a mollusk. Another factor, evolutionarily, not just home repair, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The key distinguishing features that we use to recognize a lot of these higher categories are things that have fairly pervasive basic effects. Many of them occur quite early in development. And so once something like this is established, probably in general messing with that's not as good an idea as, say, adding something on or tweaking something a little more on the edge. So, for example, in animals, a very important distinction is how the cells divide right at the beginning, and changing that, probably not such a good idea to mess up at that point. Another evolutionary consideration is if there's room for something to evolve or not. As you have more things out there, increasing competition means that probably getting specialized, focusing in on what you're already doing reasonably well is going to be more successful than radically trying out something totally different. Good chance somebody is already good at that. So, for example, right now, we don't expect to see cats evolving into dogs because they'd be competing with dogs. They're already good at being dogs, and partly in between ones, probably not going to be real successful. If dogs somehow became extinct, or perhaps if we stuck cats somewhere where there are no dogs, then there might be more of an opportunity to evolve in that direction. However, there are some situations, if there's been mass extinction, some sort of new habitat becoming available, or some key innovation occurs, then there's more possibility. So, for example, some of the latest classes to appear in the fossil record are invertebrates, mammals, birds. And this, in part, probably reflects the fact that vertebrates were able to do well on land, where very few other types of organisms are able to do very well, and so had more opportunity to do something new there than if they were trying to come up with something new in the ocean already full of competitors. Another issue is just how we classify things. There's been a big push over the past few decades to classify things in what's perceived as a good evolutionary way. It's referred to as cladistics. And part of that tends to be a strong aversion to having one thing considered at a given rank to evolve into something else at that same rank. And so you tend to demote or promote categories rather than having them go together. As an example, the acanthocephalon worm over there, it's one of the many good reasons not to eat raw meat, a parasite. And it turns out there are a few morphological connections and a lot of genetic evidence that suggests that they actually derive from the rotifers, which is a standard group of small things that swim or crawl or sit around in ponds and settings like that. And so rather than say phylum Acanthocephala evolved from the rotifers, what people strong cladistic classification say is acanthocephalans get demoted down into a class of rotifers. Similar issues exist. Whales evidently deriving from hoofed mammals. So the people taking this view don't want to say they're both categories at the same level. You need to make whales just a subgroup of the hoofed mammals, or all the stuff about birds just being dinosaurs. Well, they look a lot different. I think it's useful to call them different things, even if they're closely related, but saying birds are just a kind of dinosaur reflects this wanting to classify things at a given level. And some people even don't use the categories at all of orders and families and things like that. And then overall, the naming of higher categories is basically by hindsight. We see this group of things and we figure, hey, let's give that a name. And so to know whether anything happening today is the evolution of a new higher category, we pretty much would have to wait a few million years or whatever and see if it went anywhere. And if it did, then we would trace back and say, hey, this is the start of that. But at this point, we don't have any way of knowing what's going to go anywhere, what doesn't. So overall, both the just hierarchical categories that we use and the nature of fossil record means under any scenario, we tend to expect to see the larger categories appearing on average earlier than the lower categories. And there are some additional evolutionary reasons that you'd expect that. So again, this obviously I'm not proving a whole lot, just that this particular pattern is not a good argument against evolution, and just in general trying to think about how to be careful thinking through the ideas and apologetics. You have a lot of folks picking up something and kind of running off with it. And I think as a group, we can help a lot in trying to give more careful scientific backing to the arguments being used. So, thank you. Well, that's very much a general problem. How do you deal with a discrepancy in ideas on classifying things? And part of this, some people want to make lots and lots of categories, and some want to use fewer. Some people want to recognize more at a given level than others. So, and in general, in evolutionary context, people generally say that these higher categories are more our construct rather than entirely inherent natural categories. So there is definitely an arbitrariness of where you put things. And so to me, the best thing is, are you being consistent? Now, if you say that this group belongs at this level, well, then an equivalent group probably should go at the same level. Basically, it's the problem of deciding what is the key features to use in making the category, or evolutionarily referring to recognizing homology versus convergence or some other factor. And basically, it's just a matter of having to go through, see what multiple lines of evidence and weighing the balance on things. And it can be very complicated in deciding. Sometimes it gets pretty obvious as you go on that there's external thing. Another factor is whether, like in the case of, say, marsupial wolf and a standard wolf, well, they're both having a very similar lifestyle, so there would be reasons to expect some degree of parallelism starting from different places, whereas some other feature, say, young being kept in pouch or not as obvious how that would tie in. And so there are some ways like that that you can use to decide between them.
Any more questions?
Well, there are a number of ideas on it, and so okay, there are several possible explanations and not something that's really definitely pinned down as this is the one. So, for example, one thing that I talked a little about here, the level of competition limiting things. Roger Thomas has done some modeling of kind of what different possible shapes could you have organisms being. And it seems like at that very broad level that he examined things, pretty much all the categories that anything has ever successfully done were already occupied by the end of the Cambrian. And so it does seem as though there were more opportunities open at that point, and they've kind of been filled since then. So that's one factor. Another possibility is some degree of key innovations coming in. There were both environmental and features of organisms, like improved sensory features, hard parts, things like that, that really develop and would tend to open up a lot of new possibilities there. Another possibility is a degree of change in genetic flexibility, starting from pretty variable, and then as competition, things like that increase, again, it tends to become more advantageous to not vary so much, instead specialize in on particular factors. There are a number of types of ideas out there. I don't know that any one, and probably more than one factor is involved there, but explanations exist. Pinning down roles of relative importance of any one, I don't think has been achieved yet.
Okay, we should probably pause there. The next David.